Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker is Polish author Grażyna Plebanek. Moderating tonight's discussion is Anna Zielinska-Elliott, senior lecturer in Japanese and head of the Japanese language program in the Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe founding director, Vivian Schmidt.
Moderating tonight's event is Anna Zielinska-Elliott, senior lecturer in Japanese and head of the Japanese language program in BU's Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature. Anna Elliott is a translator of modern Japanese literature into Polish and has published over 10 translations of novels, stories, and plays by Murakami Haruki, Mishima Yukio, Yoshimoto Banana, and others. Her research interests include modern Japanese fiction and translation theory. So now I hand it over to Anna. Thank
you. We're very happy to welcome Grażyna Plebanek. For the benefit of those of you who are not familiar with her work, please allow me to say a few things by way of introduction. Grażyna was born in Warsaw, as I was, and has lived for 5 years in Stockholm and now resides in Brussels. She said in one of the interviews that, to her own surprise, her road, the road that led her to writing, was quite predictable, from studying Polish literature in college through journalism to fiction writing. She has, in fact, worked as a journalist for Reuters Agency and Gazeta Wyborcza, the largest Polish daily. While she still continues to work as a journalist and writing columns for magazines, she's best known for her novels. She's the author of 4 best-selling novels and many short stories. The novels are, Harvard Library had them all, Pudełko ze szpilkami, Box of Stilettos, from 2002, Dziewczyny z Portofino, Girls from Portofino, from 2005, and Przystupa, A Girl Called Przystupa, 2007. The fourth novel, titled Illegal Liaisons, published in Poland in 2010, was translated into English and published in the UK by Stock Press in 2012 and in the US by New Europe Books this year. The book has been reviewed by Publishers Weekly. The reviewer called it a merciless comedy of modern manners and the politics of desire, and described it as crisp and intelligent, full of pitch-perfect descriptions, mostly but not exclusively, about sex and its contemplation. I would also like to welcome Bill Pierce, who is going to do the reading later, and I would like to tell you that Bill is a senior editor of AGNI and contributes a series of essays called Crucibles. His short stories have appeared or are forthcoming in Granta, Ecotone, and elsewhere. He recently completed a novel entitled Heart Wraps. We are very happy to have the author with us today. Once again, please, let's welcome Grażyna Plebanek.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming. And I'm happy that Harvard has it all, especially in Polish. And thank you for the crispy and intelligent compliment. I think it's the best I could get. Let me just introduce briefly, before the reading, the characters of the novel. This is written from the male point of view. So the main character is Jonathan. He's the writer and the teacher of creative writing course. He's also a stay-at-home dad. So this is the reverse role of traditional gender role. His wife, Maggie, she's a lawyer at European Commission. She's also the mother of 2 kids they have together. They form quite a modern couple. They are partners, they share duties, they also are good friends. But then comes the third character, and this is Andrea. She works as a journalist for Swedish television. She has Czech roots. So the three main characters, they have Eastern European roots. They are Polish and Czech. So they remember communism, but they live in Brussels, in completely different world. This was quite tempting for me to describe Poles and Slavs after the transition, after the communist transition, and the mentality, how it changed, how people who remember communism, how they feel right now in Europe. I must say that when I created the character of Jonathan, a writer, I thought sometimes of Thomas Mann. Thomas Mann, the famous German writer, he had a very famous wife. His wife was famous for being his wife. And sometimes when I talk to my friends, also writers, we also dream about having such a wife, because she was really a perfect housewife, and she took care of everything. She took away kids when he had to write, so he was just doing his job, writing. And sometimes I think that maybe Jonathan, my main character, if he had such a wife, if Maggie was such a wife, maybe the whole thing between him and Andrea wouldn't have happened. But it happened, and I describe it in my book, which was published in England a year ago, and now it's published by New Europe Books here and in Canada. And the translation, I was told, is very good, so I'm not going to spoil this effect by my reading it with my incurable Polish accent. So that's why I'm very happy, William, that you agreed to read from my book.
Well, I know that Grażyna would have done it justice, but I'm honored to be here to do this. And it is, after all, from a male perspective, so maybe having a male voice makes some sense. This is not from the start of the novel. I'm actually starting at page 56, but it doesn't need any introduction beyond the one it just received. The week before Christmas, Maggie's colleagues from work organized a party that Jonathan called a commission Christmas party. He didn't know quite why he had to go to it. He was neither an official nor a Catholic. Maggie, who had been baptized, received First Holy Communion, and been confirmed, had become increasingly independent in her outlook as the years passed. Aunt Barbara called it leaving the church. Maggie needed the elevation of religion, jokingly called it a hunger for mysterium, but had ceased to find herself within the Catholic Church. The clergy irritated her, sermons didn't interest her, and the chasm between her and the community of childless men continued to surprise her. They had thought that in Brussels, a city with a hodgepodge of denominations in an otherwise lay country, their religious beliefs wouldn't matter. They were happy not to have faced the dilemma of their friends who'd remained in Poland, whether to send their children to religious lessons simply to stop them from feeling like outsiders. The communist schizophrenia, where one thing was said at school and another at home, was repeated in their children's generation. As if the Polish mentality couldn't stand life without authorities, Maggie screwed up her face. As if the people were writing a collective dissertation where nothing that's theirs comes from them. It's all opsit and ibid. They walked now lost in thought, Jonathan squeezed into a black jacket, Maggie with an angry expression. From the frying pan into the fire, in Brussels too, their compatriots were drawn to the church. Office workers sang in choirs, their wives taught religion, and their sons served as altar boys. I wonder what their daughters do, muttered Maggie. Whose daughters? Jonathan came to. Remember confession? A childhood nightmare, the best way to shrink the shoots of budding womanhood. Then why the hell are we going there? Jonathan stopped short. I've told you 100 times, she hissed impatiently. I've had enough questions about why I don't go to Mass. How many times can I say I'm unpacking crates? Can't you tell them you're a non-believer? Asked Jonathan, but Maggie ignored him. The host of the Christmas party, Ludwig, greeted them at the door. Jonathan noticed that he leaned to one side, which made him look subservient, but could have been the result of neglected scoliosis. We already know each other, Ludwig shook Jonathan's hand when the latter tried to introduce himself. The Christmas dishes were topped with a typical parsley garnish. Nobody had touched the food yet. They all stood around with glasses in their hands. Rafal and Martina were deep in conversation with people Jonathan didn't know. Prezimek was gazing across the room at Maggie with genuine admiration. Somewhere at the side, Jonathan heard Stefan pontificating. He noticed from a distance that he was adamantly gesticulating at a pretty girl. Monica, his wife, was nowhere in sight. Jonathan hesitated, but Stefan beckoned for him to come. Meet Victoria. Jonathan, he heard before he managed to extend his hand to the girl. Monica stood in front of him. The black dress, short hair dyed red, and the dark shawl over her shoulders made Jonathan greet her like an aunt he had not seen for a long time. He asked after her children, and Monica answered with a few smooth sentences. As usual, she had phrases suitable for the occasion. Listening to her, Jonathan thought that Maggie was right when she called Monica a black hole. Topics devoid of angle were sucked into conversational nothingness in a flash. If one were to believe what she says, he reflected, watching Monica's lips moving, one would think there's no friction in her life. He nevertheless generally defended Monica when anyone criticized her in public. Beneath the ready-made formulae, he saw a girl he'd known for 10 years and who had once come to him lugging a suitcase in one hand and holding a baby in the other. That one and only time Jonathan had been forced to mediate between her and Stefan. Before a year had been out, Franek was born. Stefan, may I? Monica smiled at Jonathan and pulled her husband aside. Jonathan glanced at Victoria standing next to him with a hesitant smile. What do you do? Desperately, he filled the awkward silence. I'm a fonctionnaire. I work with... For a while, she went on about her position and about the connections between people he didn't know, and since he didn't pick up these threads, she grew bored of him. Desperately, he tried to throw the ball into another court. Have you read The Arrangements by Elia Kazan? Was that on the reading list? When Stefan appeared with neither glass nor wife, Victoria was no longer there. What's a fonctionnaire? Asked Jonathan. Coming from him, the word sounded like the name of an insect repellent. A position in the commission for which you have to, began Stefan. Jonathan stood with the face of someone who's had a crowbar forced into his brain, making the mechanism grind to a halt. In the end, Stefan waved it aside and went to get something to eat. Jonathan followed him, but on the way he stopped short. He had caught sight of Andrea. She was standing in the door, eyeing the place and the gathering people. She hadn't exposed her legs or bust, yet there was, as usual, something intense about her appearance that turned heads. Jonathan wondered by what miracle such a woman had noticed him. Before he had time to move in her direction, she was sucked into the circle standing nearest the door. Regret racked him. He couldn't go up to her, kiss her, introduce her. He could only watch from afar as she stood there unattainable and alone. Simon had gone to England to visit his children before Christmas. Jonathan knew that better than anyone, because just 3 hours ago he had made love to Andrea in her apartment. When he finally managed to get to her, their host sprang up between them. Ludwig, she pecked him on the cheek, glancing over his shoulder at Jonathan. Ludwig watchfully followed her eyes. I'd like you to meet Andrea Kuntz, he said, an excellent journalist working for Swedish television. Jonathan's mouth grew dry. He had just caressed her, yet he couldn't get rid of the feeling that was always with him when they were together. Arousal and stage fright shook him, even when they had worn themselves out with love. And this is Maggie's husband, concluded Ludwig. It was as if someone had struck Jonathan. Ludwig greeted other guests, introducing Andrea to them, while Jonathan turned away and started to study the apartment. The interior looked as if the owner wanted to kill himself. White and beige cut through here and there with flashes of metal fittings and surfaces, everything closed, fitted, nothing protruding. He must think that by getting rid of old dishcloths and shoving the rubbish into hermetic cupboards, he's going to smooth out his own mucky insides, Jonathan thought vindictively, and muttered to himself, perhaps the son of a bitch hasn't got a soul. What's that? Maggie was staring at him, half amused, half unsure whether she'd heard correctly. Want some fudge? Jonathan answered. Not now, but thanks for buying it. You know how much I love it. Are you enjoying yourself? Maggie shrugged. Day and night, discussions about work. That document, Maggie, which category did it belong to? She grimaced, parodying the way Prezimek spoke. White paper, yellow paper, non-paper. I want to go home, she ended, and slipped her hands round his waist, beneath his jacket. Instead of returning the hug, Jonathan stiffened. Andrea was watching them above the guests' heads. I wonder where Simon is, muttered Maggie, following his gaze. Andrea was now laughing with the rest of her crowd, throwing back her long, glistening hair. Jonathan pushed Maggie's hands down. Simon, he repeated mechanically. Simon Lloyd, they came to our place, don't you remember? That's Andrea there, his woman, partner, or whatever they call her. It's hard to find a name for a concubine who's over 30. Everything sounds so infantile, but they're quite a couple. Simon, well... And she, although no classical beauty, is as radiant as an icon. She has some sort of distinction, style. She's certainly not common. Let's go and eat something. Aren't you hungry? I've already eaten. I'm going to say hello to her. Have a cabanos. They're pretty good. Maggie kissed him on the cheek and made toward the circle where Andrea shone, and which was mainly made up of men. Jonathan saw from where he stood that some of them reacted to Maggie's appearance, but a moment later all stared at Andrea again. No one can share the spotlight with her, he thought, with a strange pride, yet simultaneous stab of disappointment that they weren't looking at his wife in the same way. Without much thought, he pushed his way toward them. Simon, Andrea was saying, in England, gone to visit his children. So you've got a free pad, smiled Maggie. What's that? Andrea raised her eyebrows. It's a Polish saying. I meant, now you're alone, you can lie in bed as long as you want and parade around in your pajamas. I envy you, sighed Maggie. I've not had the house to myself for years. Andrea looked at her as if she hadn't understood that either. I'm going to get myself something to eat, she said after a while. Can I bring you anything? No, thank you. I've already eaten, Maggie replied for the second time that evening. Jonathan almost ran alongside the apartment facades. Streetlights were reflected in the windows and in the stained glass trimmings on doors that looked more like ornate church doorways than stairwells. Metal stirrups, which protruded from the walls and served for wiping shoes, assumed the forms of Art Deco. Pavements glinted with dampness. The first snowflakes of the winter stuck for a moment, then instantly melted. Winter hung in the air but did not stay for long. He turned into a one-way street and reached the middle military school. The cadets must have gone home for Christmas because the historic building stood in darkness. Only the flags swayed lazily. He ran across the street to a fence. There was nobody there the day before Christmas Eve. The arch towered over the silent park, and the green parrots had hidden themselves away. Jonathan left the playing field to the right, ran a few meters, and turned down a dark pathway leading beneath the arch. He stopped at an ancient chestnut tree and lowered Andrea's hood. The temptation grabbed him to kiss her with open eyes so that he could see her eyebrows, forehead, the snowflakes perched on her hood. He slipped his fingers beneath her hair and held her head. He wanted to suck in all of her, swaying with passion, in her, on her.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask a first question or two, and maybe we open the floor for everybody. You said in one interview that you were raised by strong, independent women. You also mentioned that your favorite character in childhood stories was the little rubber maiden from Andersen's The Snow Queen. And for those of you who don't remember what kind of character she was, let me read you two lines from the story. There is a little boy, Kai, and Gerda. And at one point, Gerda is seized by a group of robbers, and the daughter of one of the female robbers takes a fancy to her. And before they go to sleep, Gerda says, "Do you intend to keep your knife while you sleep?" asked Gerda, looking at it rather fearfully. "I always sleep with the knife," said the little robber maiden. "There is no knowing what may happen." So can you talk a little bit how growing up surrounded by strong women and liking the little rubber maiden as your favorite book character might have influenced your writing in terms of the female characters you create?
Just before I answer, thank you very much for the reading, because we just exchanged briefly. You told me yesterday that when you read your own text, sometimes you feel that it's not worth it, that the text is not good enough. And I always have this feeling as well, but not today. Thank you very much. Going back to strong women, yes, I was raised, of course, I had a father, I had a mother, but under communism, the situation of women was quite specific, because we didn't have housewives, for example. This is something very different when I talk to my friends who were raised in Western Europe, because I don't remember any mother who didn't work. So it was, of course, it was obligatory. It was the system. But in my class, we had just one girl whose mother didn't work, and I remember that in her journal there was a place to write what's your mother job, and it was written housewife, and we didn't know what it means. And we asked her several times, so what your mother is doing, really? And she couldn't answer. She said, yes, she's cooking. And my mother was cooking, too. And Frankly, women under communism had two jobs, two full-time jobs. One was working somewhere, and one was at home. So I don't have this picture of a woman who doesn't do anything. I mean, and also the history, Polish history, women were always very strong. They had to be because Poland was partitioned, and sometimes men were arrested or killed. So it was the myth of strong femininity, I have to say. And my grandmother was like this, and my mom was like this. So that's why I just like this character that you mentioned, not because of the knife, but because of the spirit. And I even used this character to write. This is actually the title of my next book, which was published in Poland in June. It's the volume of essays about women, about strong femininity.
Yes. So if I may follow up with a question on gender, can you talk a little bit about the switch of traditional gender roles in illegal liaisons, which you wrote from a men's point of view? Your earlier books were written from a male point of view, but in this book, Jonathan, whom you referred to at one point as a male version of Anna Karenina, you said that in creating this character, you had help from your male friends, with whom you discussed the fact that men think differently about emotions. Can you talk more about that? How did it work?
The research.
Especially the research, yes.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I discovered that, of course, men think differently, and of course they think differently about emotions, but also they can't talk about emotions so easily as women. I mean, it was sort of a given, but I didn't know that it's that hard. And I talked to my friends, and even now I was in Toronto at the International Festival of Authors, and I talked to one writer. We discussed this gender roles in illegal liaisons. And he, at some point, he shouted, "Men are a mess nowadays," and I couldn't agree more because I know it's not just because of this switching the roles. It's very hard to be man to be a man right now, I think, because the old pattern of manhood is not valid anymore, and I think the macho type, of course, it's gone. I know that the generation of my father, for example, was completely different than the generation of my friends right now. So, and on top of that, I live in Brussels, and this is completely different situation because Belgians, my generation, are sons of feminists. So they think differently than my generation. So I had to really talk to many friends, and I asked them how they see their roles of men, how to be a husband, a good husband today, how to be a good father. And sometimes to find this male voice in myself, I had to ask them even about describing women. So I remember that we were sitting on the bench in the park, and I asked them to comment on the women passing by, obviously whispering, not talking loudly. And I remember that there was very illuminating because they saw completely different things that I saw. So it's different point of view.
Do we have any questions or comments? Anybody has anything to say? Maybe about men being a mess nowadays?
It was a provocation. I hope somebody will feel provoked.
I actually have a question. I'm Elizabeth. I'm working at the Center for the Study of Europe here. And I wonder if you could say something about... because I see Jonathan, I know that you said one of the themes of the book was betrayal. I actually thought the theme was loyalty, course, that's the opposite of betrayal. And I was wondering if somehow Jonathan wasn't experiencing a kind of conflict of loyalties. I mean, not only to his wife, but also to himself and to his conception of himself as a writer, to his country, Poland. And I just wonder if you have something to say. In our previous series called Eurospective, we were playing with this idea of concentric circles of identity. So the idea that one would have a sort of regional identity and then maybe a national identity, and then superimposed on this is this new European identity. And I'm wondering, in your book, I'm not getting the concentric circles. I'm almost getting a sort of tug of identity, so that there's this Polish identity versus a European identity. It's not like the Polish identity fits nicely inside the European circle. And so I'm wondering how you see that, and if this was at all on your mind when you were writing the book, especially you yourself having left Poland and now living in Belgium. What is your experience of being Polish versus being European?
That's a very interesting question. I have to say that with Polish mentality, we don't really fit to Europe, because we start to, but at the beginning, Europe was really far away, and under communism, as yesterday I had on the reading, Eva wrote in your essay that if saying about myself European 20 years ago, it would be like an irony, because we didn't fit. We were completely different. We didn't have T-shirts, and but we read a lot. And when I left Poland, but this is my personal experience. When I left Poland, it was 12 years ago. I left Warsaw, and we went to Sweden, to Stockholm. I remember that first years, and it took years, really, was the process of losing my identity, my Polish identity, which was very strong, because I left Poland as an adult. I was already working as a journalist, and I knew who I was. So I was from Warsaw. I had a MA in Polish literature, and I came from the family of intelligentsia. I knew all this stuff. But when I came to Sweden and I confronted my image with what people thought in Sweden about Poles, I lost my identity, because all of a sudden they didn't know what does it mean intelligentsia. All of a sudden, they didn't know any book, any title came up from Polish literature, and I had to retell all the time, and they didn't really care. So that was my experience, to lose my identity and to gain some new kind of identity, which is partly Polish, I mean, strongly Polish, but I'm not against now European identity. I think it's blurred right now, and I adapted European's identity as well. But this is my generation. But I'm thinking sometimes of generation of my kids or Jonathan's children. They are Poles, but brought up in Belgium or in other European country, and I'm wondering, you know, what these people would think about themselves, whether they would be Europeans or Poles or Belgians. This is new concept of new Europeans.
I wanted to ask a follow-up question about Jonathan's identity, actually, because Jonathan is a very interesting character. He was born in Poland, he went to high school in Britain, and he went to college in France. So he's fully trilingual, completely comfortable in three languages. And does the fact that he conducts his affair in English mostly, do you think it influences the way he sees it? Whether it's another part of him that's conducting the affair than the part that's dealing with his wife in Polish. Or do you think he's compartmentalizing and he has different parts to him? Or do you think there is only one Jonathan, sort of? Mm-hmm. And another part is, have you ever considered, maybe, since you mentioned Thomas Mann, writing the parts of the dialogue that are in English, and then the parts that are in French? I guess some of the party conversations must be in French. Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered mixing the languages?
Mm-hmm. I did, actually. It's more and more tempting because I'm surrounded by four languages, because in Belgium people speak French and Dutch. I don't speak Dutch, but that, you know, it's present there, and also English, of course, is very present. So it's tempting, but on the other hand, I don't want to mix languages now. Maybe it will come, but so far this is my space. Polish language. It's my space and my freedom. So I rather grab to this for a while. But I think it's inevitable. I will probably start to write in or mix languages, as you said. But back to Jonathan and his trilingual personality. I think, obviously, with every language, we gain something. So he's probably in touch, when he's with Andrea, he's in touch with his English side. And maybe it's this side, a part of a teenager in him, because he was raised in England, so he was a teenager there. Maybe this is the romantic part of this character. Polish means family. He was born in Poland. So Maggie and the children, this is his family, so maybe this is the stable part of his life, and English part is more wild part. This is the part of the romance with Andrea.
Right, so you also have a character in Jonathan's writing class. Jonathan teaches creative writing, and he has a character, I don't know how you pronounce the name, Gert?
I think it's Hert in...
So he
heard in Dutch, but we can stick to Gert.
So he had traumatic experiences in his childhood. He wants to write about them, and he can't bring himself to write about them. And Jonathan suggested he could try doing it in English. Mm-hmm. And he does manage to do it in English. So is the foreign language a way to express a different part of yourself then?
That's also to keep the distance to some traumas. I think it helps sometimes if people are too close to some experiences, and there are traumas, and this was the kind of trauma in life of Hert or Gert. So I think the language could be the solution how to go through this traumatic experience.
I'd like to ask a question, if I may. I'm Mark Elliott. I'm actually married to Anna. We lived in Poland for a couple of years. I teach over at Harvard, and I'm a specialist in China. And we lived in Poland for a couple of years about 20 years ago, and I remember being struck, as I came directly from China to Poland, how insecure Poles were. This gets back to the earlier topic about European identity. How insecure Poles were about their Europeanness. And I said then, and I say now, that if you come from East Asia, Poland is unquestionably Europe. There's no ways about it. And yet, I remember cartoons from Leczko and other sorts of things, where this is very much something that Poles, you know, they look to the West, and for Poles, the West is Western Europe. Whereas, again, as I say, if you study Asia, Poland is certainly the West. But then there are different parts of Poland, and the Poles that you write about are the Poles who are much more interested in discovering their European identity, or at least are struggling with it. But as you, of course, know, there's a very significant portion of the population in Poland that doesn't want to have anything to do with Europe at all, and that wants to keep Europe at a distance, and Europe is the antithesis of everything that they hold dear, and that they consider to be the best part of Poland or Polish tradition. And I wonder if you plan to write about those people as well at some point. Is that a subject for you as a writer who is dealing with this question of the larger processes behind the integration of Poland into Europe after the fall of the Iron Curtain? Thank you.
Thank you. Actually, I did. This is this novel, and it talks. It tells the story of a young, very young woman, 20 years old, Paul, coming from a very small village in Lubelskie. I don't know if you know the map. This is quite poor region in Poland, and a lot of people leave this part of Poland, and they either go to Warsaw or abroad. My character, this is it has a form of picaresque. So this is a very strong narrator's voice who tells the story of this young woman. And she goes to the West to clean, obviously. So she's a cleaning lady. And I think I wrote it, the book was published at the same time when Polish government released posters saying, advertising Polish plumbers. And it was a very famous poster with a handsome guy as a plumber. And I remember I had the reading in Switzerland when I was... I got residency in Switzerland, and I had the reading, and I read from this book. And the woman who introduced me said, "Oh, this is an author from Poland, and we are all afraid of Polish plumbers." So... It was quite scary, but I covered this topic. You know, it's a part of our transition. I wrote before this second book is about transition from the communism to capitalism, seeing by four girls and then young women from the same district. So they remember communism, but they have to live in capitalism. But then... the book, I was inspired by all Poles kind of emigrating, they just left Poland for a year or two, they gained money and they came back usually. So this is narrator talking about this path, you know, about this journey, adventurous journey of a cleaning lady. And this is the perspective of the trash bin, and she sees Europe from this perspective. So I covered this subject.
I wonder if we should explain the plumber poster more. There was something that happened in France, some kind of incidents against Polish plumbers coming and... that's what the newspapers wrote, that Polish plumbers were coming and taking jobs away from the French plumbers. And then the Polish government came up with a poster portraying a super handsome model, blonde, tall, muscular guy, holding pipes in a suggestive way. And the copy was, "I stay in Poland," if I remember. Oh, okay. "Come visit," or something like this. And there was a similar one later about Polish nurses going to England, mm-hmm. also with a very sexy-looking nurse.
So this is something that should be good for the touristic part.
Right. Bill has a question.
I think it's a compliment to you and to the novel to say that in Illegal Liaison, men aren't a mess, in a way.
I'm so sorry, William.
The situation is certainly a mess. But Jonathan is a good teacher. He remains a good father. And Maggie herself, something that hasn't been mentioned tonight, has had an affair, quite a powerful one, an emotionally powerful one for her. And she decided, this is in the past, she decided to give it up and to return to being faithful to Jonathan. So there's a hint that maybe this same thing is going to happen in Jonathan's case, and the marriage will be stronger for it. So I wonder, you know, if there's a betrayal here, it's certainly one that has gone both directions. And if Jonathan's a mess, Maggie's been a mess also in a very similar way.
That's true. I mean, this is the mess of switching roles, and this is what happens in modern marriages or modern couples all the time. And I remember that I was, you know, because I come from Poland, where marriage should stay forever. It's really a very strong tradition, at least it was when I was brought up. But then when I moved to Brussels, I saw different model. People split all the time and people divorce all the time. And the French model, for example, is the patchwork family, so it's completely different. And in Brussels, for example, it's very interesting to see because people sometimes come for contracts for 3 years or 5 years without families, and they behave like singles. I don't judge. I mean, it's just the reality. So I think this fact that women are financially independent right now and also that the marriage is not forever anymore, it makes the mess. And I mean, feminism has this effects right now. You can call this, like in medicines, undesirable effects, maybe. I don't know, maybe it's the process of transition to different type of marriage, because maybe we are not supposed to be together for the rest of our lives. Maybe it's just a myth. Maybe it's just a way of controlling people. I don't know. Maybe we should change partners like every 7 years. So I guess it's the confusion nowadays, which is very visible. That's why I wrote this book, because I thought women are mess and men are as well, and it's just the moment of some transition, I guess.
Hi, my name is Noni Valentine, and I was a psychotherapist in Czech Republic for many years after that transition from communism. And one of the things that was very striking when I started to work with couples was that there was in that country a pattern of in relationships of dominant women and passive men. And when people started to come in to the Czech Republic in huge numbers in those years, they entered into this relationship model, and there was a kind of combustible quality that happened, and many difficulties. And I'm wondering, since you are writing about this, what your experience of that combination is of one partner coming from Poland or from the East to into a relationship with somebody who's originally, let's say, Western European or from elsewhere. Have you written about that dynamic?
I just wrote the novel that I finished about 30 years old, 30 years old woman, let's say. She's in the relationship with two men, actually. One is Belgian, one is Congolese. And I try to, you know, to explore this topic of differences. She's Pole, and they are one is definitely from the West, and one is from different continents. So I try to follow this path, because it's very, I mean, it's quite common right now to enter this kind of relationships, but probably there are difficulties, you know, with understanding each other. I don't have this experience, but I tried to talk to people a bit.
And does that stereotype that I encountered in the Czech Republic also fit for you in some way about Polish relationships?
You mean the strong women and
yes, because mm-hmm. when you spoke about the double jobs that women had, it's absolutely my experience in the Czech Republic. And there was some dynamic which I'd never fully understood that was a kind of weakening of men or fathers in some way that made a very strong dynamic of strong women and so-called weak men.
Mm-hmm. We should define probably weakness right now.
I really mean passivity. Passive.
I mean, what I can think is, for example, that for me, the weakness of men in the generation of my father, for example, was the absence of the father almost in the family. This I consider as a weakness. And now, I think in younger generations, men are definitely more present at home. But they are also closer to, I mean, couples are closer now. I wouldn't say women from Eastern Europe are stronger and men are weaker. I would say at least the generations that I describe, a generation that I described here in Illegal Liaisons, the problem between them is that they are so close to each other. They are friends, and they are working together. They are partners. And it doesn't leave any space for the romance, for example. The balance, they are so alike that Jonathan is half man, half woman, and Maggie is also half man and half woman. This is the problem with the mess, you know, with the roles, probably, that we are dealing with everything, and it's difficult to say who is stronger, who is weaker. We are very much alike. And when Andrea comes, she's very strong. Yes, she's Czech, she's very strong. And I think it makes a huge impression on Jonathan, because this is something that he doesn't have and he wants to have. And it caused the huge dynamic, sexual and erotic dynamic between them. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, you made me want to read the book. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was surprised a little bit by the fact that you are writing about all these educated professional people. They go to Brussels. It's wonderfully cosmopolitan. They are all these people from all over the place. And during the parties, they seem to be often stewing in the same old Polish sauce. And I was wondering why that is. Do you think that it will stay like that? Or do you think it's always like that? Because I know, for example, a lot of Italians in America who seem to be just meeting among Italians. Mm-hmm. So do you think that's just something that will be like that, that people feel more comfortable in their own national group speaking their own language? I just felt sorry about it a little bit, because I was thinking there are all these opportunities and all these people, but there seem to be a sprinkling of foreigners at the party, but most people are Poles. Is that true?
It's true. Yesterday I just watched briefly television, and there was an advertisement saying something that strangers are friends that you don't know yet. So maybe these Poles do not know yet this phrase. But I think it happens in circles that I were. People who just came from Poland, for example, or from Italy or Spain, they usually stick together for a while. I think it's natural reaction to look for some support. But it's also typical for people who just came and they are unsure, uncertain. What is this West really? Mm-hmm. So they stick together, and of course I would rather avoid stereotypes. But it happens that people gather around the church, for example, even in Brussels, which is quite non-churchy. But at least in my novel, the lovers go to meet in the church, not to pray, obviously. But it's quite natural process that people stick together. I feel sorry for them too sometimes.
I also wanted to ask about your pen name. You took a pen name and you said you did it because you wanted to create your own identity. You didn't want to have your father's name or your husband's name. So I understand that, but I am then thinking, so if you have a daughter, what name should she have?
It's up to her. But frankly, it sounds very feministic when you told me this, and I heard that, and it's very feministic. But no, it's I think the need, the basic need to have something, some space, and this was my space, my freedom. I just created this name, and it comes from the name of the forest that I inherited from my father. And it's kind of also the Polish tradition, because in Polish, the name of the forest is Plebanki. So if I say Grażyna Plebanek, it means Grażyna from Plebanki. And it refers also to the names from Polish literature from 15th, 16th century. We had poets like Jan Kochanowski, and he was Jan from Czarnolas, for example. So it's this tradition. But I don't feel sorry, and I don't want to explain myself. I just want to say that it's I needed my freedom, and whatever name I had, I wanted to have the new one, and this was the new one that I invented.
I would like to thank Grażyna very much for a really interesting evening.
Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a reading and conversation with Polish author Grażyna Plebanek. Tonight's event was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and the literary journal Agni. Our moderator was Anna Zielinska-Elliott, senior lecturer in Japanese and head of the Japanese language program in the Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature. We began with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe founding director Vivian Schmidt. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.